This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me.
I'm the king of the world!
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm here for today's interview episode with David Canfield.
Hi, Katie.
David, happy getting Hollywood holidays, even if you're working. Much of Hollywood is gone, but it is catch-up season for so many awards voters. And so we've got some great interviews to run over the next 2 weeks. And David, you have both of our interviews on today's episode. Let's start with Taylor Russell, who is the star of Bones and All and has really just been having this Star is Born moment. She's been at so many events. She's young and gorgeous and has been wearing incredible clothes and turns in this really commanding lead performance in Bones and All. I think a lot of people like me didn't really know much about her before, and she's really put herself on the map.
Absolutely. She won a Breakthrough Award at Venice where the film premiered, and we started by talking a little bit about just the journey that the film has gone on, and she mentioned spotting people along the way at various events who become a kind of safe harbor. And for her, that's Cate Blanchett this season. And I'm
wow.
like, what a thing to happen.
We should all be so lucky.
We should all
goodness.
Be so lucky. But very well deserved. And I think very indicative of just how quickly I think her performance has caught on and her star power in this movie opposite Timothée Chalamet. She's really wonderful in the movie and anchors what is a very bloody, gory, at times quite strange movie from Luca Guadagnino, quite effortlessly, it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, Luca Guadagnino has really developed this kind of stealthy reputation for working with actors in a way that you don't expect, and maybe they don't expect. The performances in his movies are consistently such a highlight, and you imagine for a young actor who so often they just take what role they can get, this is such a dream opportunity to show how you can hold a movie together that's strange and bloody, like you said.
Yeah, and it's interesting how quickly it's quite clear she has fallen into the Guadagnino company. She says in our interview, she's basically certain that they will work together again. And that's, I think, a special kind of bond to develop with a director. And obviously, Chalamet, Michael Stuhlbarg are in Bones and All. They've worked with Guadagnino before. It's how he tends to build up his movies and the world in which he makes them. And it's very exciting and deserving that she's now clearly a part of that world.
Maybe she'll bring Cate Blanchett with her into Luca world. That
we
would
can
be
only,
a blessing.
We can only hope. We deserve that. We deserve that.
Well, let's hear more from your conversation with Taylor Russell.
Taylor Russell, star of Bones and All, one of the wildest, I think, movies of the year and also one of the more beautiful ones. This movie's gone on quite a journey since you premiered it in Venice. And I wanted to start by asking you about how the rollout of the movie would compare to what I think was your first experience with this kind of rollout, which was Waves a few years ago. I know it wasn't your first movie or anything, but it was kind of introduction to this, you know, level of industry, this side of the industry. What do you remember about that time and maybe the more newbie stuff that you've been able to carry now into this experience?
With both Waves and Bones and All, I was with a group of actors and all the filmmakers that made those movies respectively. I loved a lot, so I was happy to keep seeing them again and again throughout, you know, the fall season of promoting each film. I really enjoy also, you know, seeing other films and it's really lucky to be able to meet the filmmakers who are making those films while your film is out and just kind of, I don't know, compare or have a friendly face in the room, just like run and hold a hand. And Kate is a great example. I saw her in Venice, won her award, of course, and then I've seen her a few times since, and it's very lucky that I can say that I, you know, can go up to Kate and say hi now.
Kate Blanchett, right?
Kate Blanchett, yeah. And I loved Tar so much. I think her performance is wild and incredible. But yeah, there's kind of special little gems like that. And I'm lucky that I can keep learning and hopefully keep learning being in this industry and making more films like this.
Yeah, from my perspective, it feels like such a whirlwind, just like seeing all of the places that you guys are going. Like when you did Waves, for example, do you remember like the first person or like the first time that you were like maybe had that kind of like Kate-like experience where you could say like, okay, this is a kind of surreal but safe harbor for me and all the craziness?
You know, I loved Phantom Thread so much. Mm-hmm. And I saw Vicky Krapes at Telluride the first time that I went. And I had just seen Phantom Thread and was so excited to meet her. But I was trying to play it very cool. So, yeah. People like that I've remembered throughout the years.
Yeah. So with this movie, especially when you were in Venice, you know, there is a certain degree of fandom around this movie with Timothy and you as well. And it seemed like quite a scene. Was it kind of, especially as you're just launching this movie, and I'm sure there's a lot of anxiety around how it's going to be received and everything, was that kind of weird to navigate, or how did that feel, especially coming off of Waves with this being, you know, your kind of next big premiere?
I was really just excited. I maybe should have had more trepidation, but I just felt like there was so much love that went into this story and so much care, and it is a love story to me. So that felt like it was at the forefront of, you know, my thinking about it coming out and the world receiving it.
In terms of, especially early on, how you found conversations around the movie, you know, this is a, to some extent at least, a polarizing movie. It elicits pretty intense reactions. Like, what kinds of things did you find people asking you about a lot? What kind, and whether it was, you know, people like me or just, you know, people who'd seen it who were, you know, viewers, what were those conversations like, and how did you think about the way people were reacting to the movie?
Well, in the theater, the first time I saw it was in an audience at Venice. You know, I heard some laughing, which was interesting because I, you know, at uncomfortable moments, and then did, you know, research after and found out why that was. It's an uncomfortable thing. But also, you know, hearing that some people got sick watching the movie, or those are really surprising reactions to me, just because I think always when you're on the inside of something, it's never going to be how other people receive it in terms of maybe the grotesque elements of it. But yeah, those sort of reflections were different than I thought that they would be, but I get it. Yeah, I think the amazing thing about this movie is that you can kind of, everyone is going to have a different takeaway. And if the love story is what hits you, then that's great. But also there's a lot of other elements of displacement and, you know, feeling like a loner, or maybe you're somebody who just saw the horror parts of it, and that's okay too. There's a lot of doors into the film, and I've heard of really kind of every sort of reaction that you can think of. Very weird questions and very heartfelt questions.
I have to ask what the weirdest question you've gotten is then.
I had somebody ask me if I've had people reach out expressing their love of, or like if, you know, I don't know, something around the cannibalism, and the answer is no. Nobody's said anything
like from
weird.
From the cannibal community.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, the answer is 1,000% no. I've had sweet, sweet messages. Nothing like that at all.
Okay. That is a weird question.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a weird question.
Yeah. But this is the kind of
movie. But, you know, it's a
weird movie, so. Yes, I was going to say, this is the movie that's going to lead to those kinds of questions. Yeah. So it's good to be prepared for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, to that point, though, you know, Luca Guadagnino's, your director, is someone who has very specific ideas. I've interviewed him about this film a couple times. And in terms of the weird factor, was that, I suppose, acknowledged in your early conversations with him, especially given also how deep this movie is and how it balances these elements of real intimacy and gore, and it has all these elements. I'm curious how you kind of wrapped your head around it as you spoke to him about it.
You know, at that point when I met Luca for the first time on FaceTime, he didn't audition me for the role. That had never happened to me in my career before. But he had seen Waves and I guess felt like he saw something. I don't know what. And when I read the script for the first time and read this girl, this strange person who felt like she was on the outside looking in, and coupled with, you know, kind of finding your soulmate in your weirdness, that was what hit me and struck me more than anything. And I think maybe it kind of sounds unbelievable to hear that, considering the chrysalis of cannibalism that holds this movie. But I was so desperate to play a character that I felt encompassed all these parts of my heart and soul that hadn't really been explored yet. And feeling like this was the vehicle to do that was the most exciting and the biggest part to me. And I knew that, you know, Luca was going to take care of the rest. Like, my concern was the emotional storyline and keeping that and finding her. And I thought, okay, I don't really need to worry about all the gore and all that, because Luca will hold me there and take care of that part of it. And I'll learn a lot when I get to Ohio and start filming on how to navigate that part of it. But I think, yeah, from other actors I've talked to, at least, I can't speak for all of them, but we're always terrified about getting the emotional beats right. And the physicality of the cannibalism kind of felt like an afterthought in a way.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Given the degree to which you did connect to this character and feel, you know, that she was right for you to play, not that you had any disagreements with Luca, but as he is someone who kind of knows what he wants and you get to filming, like, what kinds of, I suppose, back and forth did you have, or what particular parts of the movie maybe were there the most conversations about that you felt strongly about?
Every day is different with Luca, I think, in general, as a filmmaker. I haven't worked with him. I've only worked with him once, but that's kind of the sense that I get, that it's always going to be spontaneous and you're never really going to know what's happening. which is scary. I mean, mm-hmm. I was scared every day going to set. Can I do what is required for what I want, you know, in my kind of perfectionist brain, but also for Luca and for my cast members. And the unpredictability of it, I think I worried a lot about that. But also, I think the way that I gelled into their circle, I'm more introverted, and I take a while to kind of process things and have mm-hmm. my feelings on it. And I was pushed out of my comfort zone in a lot of ways. So in terms of back and forth with Luca, I mean, there was back and forth every day because things were always different and we were shooting in a place that none of us had ever been before. But there wasn't any specific, you know, disagreements about character or whatever. He kind of just saw what I was doing and let me run free in a lot of ways and be wild.
Hmm. Did Timothy or even like Michael Stuhlbarg give you some tips on navigating that unpredictability? Lay it out for you, like, this is what he's like at all?
You know, actually, Fernanda Perez, the makeup artist who's worked with Luca for 30 years, they've been friends for 30 years, who's so excellent, who also, I don't think I could have done the movie without. She really supported me from the beginning to the end. I asked her on the first day, if you have advice for me, what would it be? Because she's known him for so long. And she said, don't try to do anything you've done before. Be wild and jump off the cliff. Something to that effect. And I just thought, okay. That felt very clear to me. And I think that's pretty good advice for entering a Luca set, if anybody who listens to this is going to work with Luca. Keep that in mind.
It paid off.
Yeah.
Your old self is gone.
Yes, we've locked her away.
Yeah. I know Luca brings a lot of, you know, reference points, films that he loves, that he brings to everything he does. And he gave you kind of a watch list, right?
Yeah, he did.
Was that for, like, specifically for you? Did he give it to the rest of the cast? And how was that experience for you?
No, that was a list specifically for me. and all movies that I've watched again since, after filming, Jean Guillemin, the Chantal Ackerman film, Vagabond, Agnes Varda, In the Realm of Senses, I think Oshima, Germany, Year Zero, and A Man Escaped. I mean, they're vastly different films, but they have, you know, most of them, with exception of In the Realm of Senses, which is about lovers, it's about this one person who's fighting against the environment, trying to blend with it, but also trying to get out of it. And that, you know, the stirring that is born from there. And also Luca's, I think one of his gifts is that he thinks about the physicality of a character a lot. And when you look at Luca's movies, you can tell distinctly, you know, how Elio moves in Call Me By Your Name, how Jack Dylan Grazer moves in We Are Who We Are, and Tilda Swinton in A Bigger Splash, and Dakota Johnson in Suspiria. All these characters feel very specifically physical. And before we started, he said to me, you know, you tend to be more graceful as a person. You need to feel more like a rock, like there's a heaviness to you. And that was really helpful too, because I was just throwing my body around in different ways all day. And I grew up dancing, so I think about body and movement a lot anyway. And I those challenges are fun.
Yeah, in terms of those movies, he can really give you a pretty incredible education, I feel like.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Agnes Varda now I have a newfound love for.
Yeah, and she's very evident in his work, I think.
Yeah.
So with all of that, what he's, you know, this sense of like trying something new, forgetting what you've done before, like what do you discover about yourself as an actor in that process on this movie and going forward?
Well, I feel what I felt during this movie and what I'm noticing in as an actor, as I keep going on this path more, is that you kind of end cycles through characters, or you can. And playing Marin and Bones and All felt like the end of some sort of emotional cycle for me. And now I feel like even what I'm reading, what I'm interested in at the moment, art that I'm drawn to, feels like my palette has been cleansed and is changed in a new way. And what I'm looking for in whatever I do next feels different than what I was interested in prior. So I'm interested to see how that kind of trickles into the work and where that takes me. But I think it's pretty necessary, or else you're going to be playing the same characters again and again. And not that that's a bad thing, but it's not exactly the way that I want to do things. Mostly, I think, just because I am a contradictory person in my heart and am interested in a lot of, I want to hear different perspectives, and I'm more interested in maybe not understanding something and disagreeing with somebody than feeling comfortable and that we're all on the same page. I think there's some value to be found in that. So whatever was born in, through the process of shooting Bones, of don't use any of the tricks or don't do anything you've done before, has lasted in me throughout, you know, the past year and a half since we wrapped.
I'm also curious, just from the outside looking in, the Luca company feels like a really fun place to be in. And he does tend to work with people a lot. I feel like you're kind of in that company now. How would you describe the experience of, like, after you make the movie and you guys are, you know, as mentioned earlier, doing a lot of stuff together, but also he's clearly a fan of yours. What is that experience like of just being in that circle, I suppose?
Oh, it's the luckiest circle to possibly be in ever as an actor. It's like, I don't know, Mecca in some way. Yeah, he keeps great company other than the, you know, the wonderful actors in his wheelhouse. There's just the people around him, Fernanda and Massimo and his producers that he's worked with for a long time. It really does feel like such a tight-knit family, and you kind of can't enter his world without knowing and loving and being kind of enmeshed with everyone in it. And I have, you know, 15 new family members, I feel like, from working with Luca. I feel very privileged to say that, you know, I know we will work together again. We're very fond of each other. I hope I can say that. Lucas said that.
I get so the I'm sense. He said it. You're safe.
Yeah, I can't wait until the day that I work with him again. And I hope I work with him for the rest of my career. We're all kind of similar in a wild way, which is what I've noticed about his family group. But I feel so lucky to be a part of it, and I feel so loved within that family. So it's a nice, it's more than nice. It's like winning the lottery.
Yeah. Is there a scene in the movie, I'm particularly interested in maybe a scene with Timothy where it went in a direction you didn't expect, either in playing it or in watching it back, because both Luca and Timothy are known as people who, as you say, are very spontaneous, who like to discover new things on the fly. And I'm getting the sense you're like that as an actor as well. So there's probably a lot of room for things to go in unexpected directions.
Yeah, definitely. In my life, I'm most certainly like that. And on a set and when I'm working, I want my eyes to be opened in a new way, which is why it's invigorating to work with Timmy and Luca, because that's the priority for all of us on set and in a scene. One of my favorite scenes of the film, and the one that went in a different direction maybe than I had thought about it prior to shooting it, was the scene on the cliff in Nebraska in the third act of the movie when we're talking about Timmy's, or Lee's dad. And, you know, I can't even say specifically what I thought about it. You know, you have these ideas of how it's going to go or what you need to do or what the moment is. And both of us really just after reading it for the first time or doing it, we're like, okay, this is different than we thought it was going to be, but perfect, sink into that. And it should, it shouldn't be what we thought it was going to be. And it is what it is right now. And even if we can't understand it, it's right on. Even if it doesn't feel good, it's here right now, which means it's right. And that sort of giving up to, you know, the moment, I think is important. And you need to have that trust as an actor. And when you're working with other actors who have that level of trust of the present moment, then that's when the best stuff is born. But that scene surprised me. And after, I felt like I was just so curious to see how it turned out. But I love Timothy's acting in that scene, and also the setting is just beautiful. And mm-hmm. Yeah, we were up for 3 days and nights. I felt like we didn't sleep for for a few days. Wow. Shooting that, because we had to shoot at sunrise and sunset to get the right light.
It must be a different kind of experience than to go to a studio, which you mentioned with Mark and Timothy for the finale, which the movie's out. We can talk about it a little bit. Given like the intensity of that sequence, like how would that contrast in terms of like just wrapping your head around how that's going to go, and like down to the makeup, because by the end of that sequence, there's a lot of makeup work.
Well, it was the first time that Mark, Timmy, and me had all three been in a scene together.
Right.
And we were just, you know, asking Mark questions all the time. And Mark's always on set, so he's around and really present. And it was just fun. It was just fun to work with them. And it was together. And it obviously is a very uncomfortable, gory scene. But at the same time, it felt very free, even though we were in a studio. Because there was this little container of this room that we could go wild in. So the contrast between working outside and kind of having so much space and then being in a confined environment and having to create that space. The biggest thing I remember actually is that there's a close-up of blood going in my eye and Luca, like a little kid, the camera was very close up, and Luca came asked to spray the blood in my eye and had like a spray bottle, and just it made me laugh so much because I thought, yeah, this is it. It's gory and bloody and all these things, but there's so much fun actually beneath it all, and we're all like little kids in a way.
Okay, David, now let's hear your conversation with Bill Nighy, the star of Living, a movie that premiered almost a year ago at the Sundance Film Festival. And I think people like us who really keep an eye on awards things ever since have been being like, you know what, Bill Nighy, like, that movie's got something. This might be his moment. And lo and behold, it's Bill Nighy's moment. He keeps getting nominated for everything. He sure seems to be a major contender in the Best Actor race. How's he feeling about all this?
I think he's very humbled by it, perhaps a little overwhelmed. This is a character actor of many, many decades in this business who has very rarely been the face of a project, especially a movie. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the movie premiered at Sundance. So he's been talking about this movie, being the face of this campaign for a very long time. And, you know, he seems very happy to do it. I think he's also maybe taken a bit aback by how much affection there is, both for his performance here and for what's felt like a kind of career capping moment with a lot of opportunities to talk about the road he's had in Hollywood and beyond.
I mean, he's a character actor, as you said, so he's been part of really, you know, big popular ensembles, like Love Actually being a major example. But Living is his movie. He is at the center of it. And his gravity kind of dominates the whole thing. It's this very, in some ways, straightforward movie, you know, about this man who's kind of learning how to live after getting a fatal diagnosis. But he's so crucial to why the entire thing works. You can imagine why everyone is really falling over themselves to praise him for it, but also the pressure that would bring.
I think what's really special about his performance here is that it, you can see some of the choices that he makes in a way that doesn't feel too actorly or anything, but very key to the character. We talked about his character's voice and how he comes in so quiet, and then this singing scene where he really comes alive, the physicality of really embodying the period and what it meant to be a British man in this period. And he plays it so naturally, but also so deliberately, and also so warmly. And there's so much affection in his performance for this character that I think translates to everyone watching.
Yeah. Well, let's hear more from your conversation with Bill Nighy.
Bill Nighy, you're here to discuss your film Living, which is already a big hit in the UK. I've heard from a lot of people who've seen it. Has it surprised you the lengths that this film has already traveled and the amount of people it's found, given that it, you know, was a small Sundance discovery?
Yeah, I don't think anything could have prepared us for the depth of the response and the kind of universal welcome that this film's got. I thought we were making a good film, and I knew we had a great script from Kazuo Ishiguro, the Nobel Prize winning novelist, and I knew that Stephen Woody is one of the great English film producers of all time, and the cast were impeccable. I knew I was in good hands. And Oliver Hermanus, the young director who'd never made a film outside of South Africa before, turned out to be a genius, along with Jamie Ramsey, his cinematographer. All of those things were, you know, plain, but you never know, you know, you can't, and it is a, you know, it's a film where nobody carries a gun and nobody takes their top off. I did offer to take my top off, but they told me to put it back on.
Next time.
Next time, maybe. But it was, you know, number one across the nation, and that's, I find it very obviously gratifying and very moving that should be the case, that you never know.
Mm. Yeah, Oliver Hermanus is not necessarily the director you would expect to make this movie as a young South African. This film is very steeped in 50s British life and the conventions and mores of the time. So how did he strike you as you started making this movie, started talking about it? I suppose he brings a different kind of perspective, maybe.
Well, yes, I think I know that Stephen Woolley and Mr. Ishiguro were looking outside of England for a director, just so that somebody would have some distance and would have a foreign eye, because it's so much about English convention and that particular 50s kind of English life. They wanted someone who could view that as an outsider, as something exotic, and comment upon it accordingly. And also, we'd all seen Moffie, M-O-F-F-I-E, which is Oliver's previous film, when we were all blown away by that. So I knew I was in good hands. You know.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of Ishiguro, that's really the roots of this project are with him, and particularly your involvement in it. I believe his plan was to write this sort of remake, it's very much its own thing, for you. What is one's reaction to something like that, especially when it is one of the most decorated writers of our time?
I know, it's hard to contain the information when you first realize that that's what's happening. All I did was go to dinner. I went to dinner with Stephen Woolley and his wife, Elizabeth Carlson, also a great producer, and the other guests were Mr. and Mrs. Ishiguro. And at the end of dinner, he said, "We know what your next film should be." And I thought he was kind of kidding, you know. And then a couple of weeks later, Stephen rang and said that this was his suggestion. Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's an incredible development as far as I'm concerned. You know, it was, I would never have imagined that something like this could happen. And then there's a degree of apprehension because you don't want to mess it up. You know, this is such an opportunity. So, and it turns out, you know, even I have to admit, I didn't mess it up.
You did not.
It's
one of my favorite performances of yours, which is saying something, because you've had quite a career. And I think a lot of that is rooted in how subtle it is and how subtle it has to be, given the kind of character you're playing. Starting with, I suppose, the voice and the soft-spoken nature of this character, I believe that you didn't really even know how you would approach it until you started filming. Is that right?
That's sort of right, yeah. I mean, I'd studied hard, and I'd said the lines over and over and over and over and over and over again in order to give the impression that I'd never spoken them before. That's the gig. That's my job. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what actors do. It's not rocket science, but it's not nothing either. But the actual tonally, I think I really only arrived at that particular tone when I first spoke the very first line of the movie. And I did expect the sound man to come over and say, Bill, please, really? We're going to do this for 7 weeks? But he never came near me, so I just kept going. And it seemed to be, maybe I decided prior to that, I did feel that he would have a kind of reluctance to make too much noise. You know, I figure he's someone who's, he lost his wife at a very early stage in their marriage, and he's been institutionalized in grief since then. And his personality and his way of presenting himself in the world has formed around that grief, around that loss. And it seemed therefore, I don't know, logical that his voice might struggle to make it out of his body, you know, and that his physicality would be reduced, would be movement would be, there would be no sudden moves, and there would be an energy that was, that most of his energy goes into containing things rather than expressing anything.
Mm. Was that a different way of going into a character for you? I associate you often with a certain kind of exuberance, maybe, and obviously you've played a range of characters, but this is one where he is extremely, at least initially, limited, and we see this blossoming over the course of the film, but it's a very specific way that you have to start.
Yeah, it is. It is unlike, I mean, I have played what they call quiet men before, quiet people before, but this, I suppose, is different from other things I've done. And I welcome that. I didn't really think of it in the context of my career or anything. I just, you know, you just try and do the whatever's put in front of you at the time, you know. But yeah, it is different. And it was, and it's quite grueling because it physically, because it does actually, weirdly, it requires quite a lot of energy to contain everything and to sort of be that uptight. Yeah. Is quite, you know, is not nothing.
Given that, I wonder if you can talk about the singing in this movie, which is when this character comes to life, and it seems like you as a performer do get to do exactly what you're saying. You know, get out of that.
Yeah,
shell
yeah,
a
quite.
Bit.
Well, yeah, it was. It's a very. It's a weird thing for me. Singing is not something. I mean, I like singing when there's nobody around, and I do it a lot around that. You know, like everybody. I sing around the house and whatever. But singing publicly, I'm not entirely comfortable with it. I've had to do it in a few movies, but luckily, I've never had to be really, really good or anything. I have played as a professional singer, but he wasn't supposed to be, you know,
right.
Robert Plant. You know, he wasn't supposed to be, you know, a terrific singer. And this is just this guy. This in this movie, I'm an amateur. I'm a guy who's had a few drinks in a bar, so I'm not supposed to be, you know, Caruso. But within the story and the fact that it's the singing that unlocks his emotions, then I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm involved in. And it was very useful. It's like at funerals where you're fine until you're required to sing and then you fall apart. You get to the second line and you can barely, you know, get through it because it does seem to unlock something in you. And the song, luckily I didn't know prior to shooting that scene, that song is a very, very special song for Mr. and Mrs. Ishiguro. It's like Lorna is Scottish, and it's one of their favorite songs, and it has meaning for them as a couple, which would have just added to the pressure. So I'm glad I didn't know until afterwards.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
I'm curious if you've had another experience on a film where you kind of came in knowing a part was written for you, essentially.
Yeah, I have. I mean, over the years, people, sometimes there is a, you know, sometimes people will say, oh, I wrote this for you. And then they send you the script and you've got two scenes and seven lines. And you think, oh, you were thinking of me. Well, you weren't thinking of me very substantially. Or there's the other one where they say they wrote it with you in mind, but you don't believe them because you think it's a way of sweet-talking you into getting taking the job. But I have actually done, you know, David Hare, who I've worked with all my life, mm-hmm. the great English writer. I made 3 films with him for the HBO, BBC HBO, which I know, which are now on Netflix, called the Warwicker Trilogy, yes. Which I now know were written with me in mind. Joe Pennell wrote a play called Blue Orange, which he says he wrote for me, and I choose to believe him.
Okay.
So I have had that experience before, but it doesn't really, you know, they don't write precisely for your speech patterns or anything. You know what I mean? It doesn't.
Yes.
People have the idea that it makes it easier or something. It doesn't. It's just the job remains the same, but it's a fabulous, you know, when people start writing things with you in mind, you have my attention. Mm.
Especially in the case of a movie like this, where it does go on quite a journey. You know, it gets this kind of campaign rollout and you are the face of it. How have you found that experience, especially given it's safe to say you're more associated with, at least in bigger movies, more supporting roles?
Yeah, it feels good. You know, I mean, I'm just very, very happy that this film, this was the first film I did after COVID. And everybody was kind of, and it was the same for a few people involved. Mm-hmm. And I found that very affecting, not just that we were making a film and we were back and we were in one piece and, you know, and it was possible, but also that we were making this film and telling this story, which I think it would always have been timely, but it's super timely now. And I was very, and the fact that it's caught fire and has opened so rapturously in the UK is, you know, you can't be prepared for, and it's, you know, I'm thrilled by that. You know, don't mistake me for anyone who isn't absolutely, you know, over the moon about that. The fact that I have to front it, yeah, you know, I mean, it can be kind of daunting sometimes. You know, you think, please, can you all look the other way for a while? But you know, it's what they call a champagne problem. So I'm going to shut up. I'm gonna shut up and get on with it.
I don't believe I'm the first to have said some nice things about you in this movie, though. It's been out there.
yeah. No, I don't actually read anything, but I am alerted to the facts. You know, I know that we're doing okay.
Yeah. One other element of taking this movie around during award season is getting to, I suppose, encounter your, I don't want to call them competitors, but other people who are in this season. And it struck me that a number of actors like yourself, including Brendan Fraser and Colin Farrell, are having this kind of moment where, you know, they've been in this industry for a long time and there's a lot of recognition for what they've done this year. And I'm curious if you've, you know, encountered them and experience what it's been like to experience going on this with other folks.
Yeah, no, I met Brendan Fraser for the first time. He was gracious and charming. And I met Paul Dano, and I met all in at the same time. And I met Austin Butler and Jonathan Majors, and I met Adam Sandler. You know, we all sat around a round table. It was kind mm-hmm. of excruciating. You know, I mean, but they're all very, very cool guys, and everybody knows the situation. And no one's got their tongue hanging out. You know, it's like, we've been around, so it's like, and the celebrations can already begin. You know, you don't have to.
Right.
You know, it's fine. You're mentioned in dispatches. It's great. You know, I it was great to meet all those guys, and they were all very sweet and very cool. And I was particular, I have to say, because Punch Drunk Love is one of my favorite films of all time. And that performance, I told Adam, I was determined that I wasn't going to tell him, because I thought, don't do it, don't gush all over him, just be cool or something. And then as soon as I met him, I told him, you know, I just found myself saying, you know, Punch Drunk Love is one of my favorite films, and Uncut Gems is incredible, and you're marvelous in The Hustle. And after I saw Punch Drunk Love, I wrote his name on the front of my next script, because I didn't want to forget, you know, what he'd achieved in that film. And I was that kind of deeply integrated. You go straight into cliche when you try and talk about this, but it's sort of buried comedy, which is, you know, where no one gets caught trying to be funny, and yet the audience fall apart every minute and a half. It's just, it's a magnificent, and it's very, very moving and totally truthful. You know, everyone in that movie is fantastic, you know. So yeah, I was very pleased to meet him, and he was, you know, super cool and very, very solicitous and gracious, lovely, as I do, you know, as they all were. So yeah, but it is an odd situation, you know, acting as a competitive sport. It's sort of
it is
bizarre.
Odd.
it's sort of bizarre, you know. But everybody knows the score. Everybody knows what that, you know, everyone's cool.
Yeah, I think it is nice when you get a group of people who exactly as you say, know the game, have been doing this for a long time, and yeah, maybe deserve a little bit of a moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Why not?
So for this year, I was going over your credits, and you had, you know, a leading role in this film. You have a role in a Florence and the Machine music video. You played an alien in The Man Who Fell to Earth. You voiced the speaker in the video game Destiny 2.
Wow.
That is a very singular 2022 resume, I would say.
Yeah, no, that is, I'd forgotten about a couple of those. Yeah, it was great. Yeah, it was lovely. It was lovely to be with Florence. She's impressive. My God, she's exemplary. She was wonderful to work with. That was a tough, they're tough, those shoots, you know.
Yeah.
The sad thing about that was that we were in Kyiv just a few couple of months before the war broke out. So having been in that city, that beautiful city, it was even more kind of tragic to hear about the developments. Anyway, but yeah, that's a very, I like it when it gets varied. You know, I've been lucky like that. You know, I get to play a range of parts. When I was young and sort of eligible to play romantic parts, although I wasn't quite kind of, you know, cute enough, but I was I was sort of in the that vague sort of category. I was very uncomfortable playing those kind of parts because I thought you had to sort of be it rather than act it, and I certainly didn't feel it, so I was, you know, I was a bit at a disadvantage. And she understood that, and she started sending me up for what would be called character parts, and I got to do a range, you know, and I got some of them. And I would get to do different voices or different, you know, all kinds of stuff. So I think the seeds of it began there.
How do these different kinds of projects come to you? And how do you, I suppose, decide what you're going to do? Because it is, you know, from a music video to a film like this, it's a huge range.
Yeah, well, I'm just very, very, very lucky. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, the music video came because I know Florence a little bit. I knew her before a little bit. But mostly because, and obviously that was her decision, but also because I know Autumn de Wilde, who directed Emma, the Jane Austen adaptation I was in. She's a remarkable person and a terrific director, and she was directing those videos. So that kind of came from that. It's odd. I don't know how these things happen, but, you know, connections are made and one thing leads to another.
In your career, you've made quite a few crowd pleasers, films that people watch over and over again. I know you don't watch your movies. Does it get weird hearing about these movies over and over again in specific scenes and things like that?
Well, sometimes it's, on this one, it's been a bit strange because people are so taken with this movie that they do get down to details, and they say, you know, the scene where you're, you know, sitting on the sofa. And you're like, well, not really. I kind of remember sitting on the sofa, but I don't remember what happened. So it's okay because I'm not lying. I used to sort of, I didn't, did I lie? I probably did lie. I used to pretend, or at least I would allow people to have the impression that I'd seen the film, because I thought I didn't have the courage to say, do you know what, I can't watch. But now I'm old enough, I can say, you know, I don't watch. But as for hearing about films over and over again, I don't mind at all. You know, I don't mind. The film that I think most, up until now, the film that most people talk to me about is, with By a Mile, because I don't own a car and I walk around everywhere and I meet a lot of people. And the film that they more than, and a lot of young people, is About Time.
Mm.
You know, because that seems to have, that's rude, that's a stayer. You know, you never know. But that's entered the language, and it's not just buried somewhere. It's an active part of the scene. You know, people are watching it more than once, and people are watching it for the first. You know, it's still going on. It's still happening. So that's probably and also Richard Curtis made a brilliant film, and he really hit the spot, and it's meant a great deal to people.
Yeah, that's also a movie that it didn't have the biggest opening necessarily, but it's had quite a life.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, that's not an unfamiliar trajectory for Richard. I think there's a certain level of criticism which is squeamish about feeling, real feeling. But it takes guts to make those films. It takes guts to make films about how remarkable we are, how tender and compassionate we can be to one another, how all of us have an emotional connection with one another. And there are plenty of films about suicide and heroin, if you want that kind of thing, you know, there's plenty of those. But he chose not. Mm-hmm. He chose to make searingly honest films about how good people can be, rather than, they're never called searingly honest, because that's a phrase that's reserved for films about how bad people can be.
Mm-hmm. I think in a way you can draw a line from that to a movie like Living, in terms of what it leaves you with and the kind of spirit of it.
Absolutely, yeah. It's one of those, you know, it's one of those films you come out of the cinema and you feel, strangely, even though it's a sad story, you feel better. You feel inspired in some way, even if it's just that you've watched something that taps you into humanity, or a feeling of a unifying kind of feeling. That we, you know, we might all be in with a chance if we stick together.
Hmm. I would guess that after 20 years of hearing about Love Actually, you probably may as well have seen it in terms of the amount of details you've been
given. To be honest, Love Actually, I did watch. And I watched it. I watched it at the New York premiere, because it was 20 years ago. And there was a lot of pressure. There's always a degree of pressure.
Sure.
Because the director wants you to see it. They want you to see what they've done, and, you know, all of that. And I'm quite good at resisting that. But because I have to, because it's a practical consideration and I have to. But when I went to New York, and it was, you know, that film changed my life. It changed the way I go to work. It changed everything. Uh-huh. And I can never be more grateful enough to Richard Curtis. And there was a big, you know, I'd never been to a big premiere where I had a reasonable part, you know. I had a great part, and I went, I was there with my family, and they, you know, I couldn't find an attractive reason for hanging out in the lobby. Do you know what I mean? It would have just looked really weird. So I did sit down and watch it, and the thing about that is it got laughs. So if I get laughs, I'm sort of okay, because that's indisputable. Yes. They all laughed at the same time when I kind of arranged for them to laugh. So job done. Doesn't matter what I look like, doesn't matter what I sound like, you know, you got laughs, and that's indisputable.
It's kind of the feedback you'd learned from theater, I would think.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely.
Yeah. So after Love Actually, I believe you said you basically had to stop auditioning. Is there a role that you've played, though, that you did have to really fight for?
I actually had to fight for to play Grand Santa in Arthur Christmas.
Love it. That's the best answer.
Because Sarah, who made the film, the brilliant woman who made the film, she insisted, you know, and she was quite right. You can't just say, yeah, I'll play Grand Santa, because it's too much of a risk to have somebody turn up on the first day and come up with some terrible voice.
Sure.
So yeah, I had a long audition. It was like, on a microphone for some hours, you know, before she said, yeah, you got the gig. So I was very pleased about that. I don't fight for roles. I've never fought for a role in my life. Not because I am above such things or anything, but it's just, I don't know how you do it. And I've never felt confident enough to do that. I know you hear stories about actors finding the producer's phone number, personal phone number, or going around their house and standing in their garden and saying, give me this, I just wait and see what they say. I've never had the confidence really to, I've really never had the confidence to do that.
That does it for today's episode. We'll be back on Thursday with our last roundtable episode of the year, answering some of your burning questions about award season. You can email us with those or anything else at littlegoldmen@vf.com, or find us on Twitter at HWD or on our own. I'm at Katie Rich, and David?
David Canfield, 97.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.